Friday, August 6th, I slept late in the Tower of the Princess and got up just in time to be ready for Molly Parnas, who arrived with a maid and a fitter at 10:30. Just back from Rome last night and not yet gone to her office. The next 2 hours were exercise and decisions. Trying on, fitting, trying on, modeling, filling in the holes of the wardrobe I had last year, deciding what would take the place of last year's most useful this or that, beside the lovely white silk Roger dress I'd already purchased. I got a white cocktail ensemble coat and dress, and a dark green alouette silk dress and jacket, and finished thoroughly confused and uncertain, asking Miss Parnas to send me sketches of a grand evening dress for the party for Princess Margaret in November, something with paillettes and great glitter up top, but not an absolute sheath of it from head to toe. Some of them looked like a crusader in shining mail or a mermaid, and I'd best stay in the role of a rather quiet, hopefully well-dressed 50-year-old. I'd talked to Lyndon that morning, had told him I'd be back by dark, ready to do anything he planned. He reminded me of the signing of the voting rights bill. It was to be in the Capitol, where in 57 he had made his first sizable stride in pushing the civil rights movement. It would be a dramatic setting, completely inefficient, I forgot to watch. But later, I was proud to see that Lucy had not forgotten. She was right there by her daddy's side, walking in, her hand in his. It was a dramatic setting, a dramatic occasion. But the picture of Everett Dirksen standing behind Lyndon thrust a little fear into my heart. He looks ill. I had sandwiches and soup with Molly Parnas while she told me about seeing Mary in Europe. A peach wool dress and jacket with a mink collar and cuffs would be my best arrival costume. I was satisfied and glowing, and at the same time confused and uncertain with that feeling a woman has who shopped a lot. When we walked out of the Carlisle, headed for Greenwich to see the Joseph Hirshhorn collection. Mrs. Hirshhorn had called me the day before and asked if we could drive out to see it. I was torn between wanting to very much and realizing we'd only have about an hour to be there if I were to get home in time to spring Lyndon loose from his desk for a 2-day weekend, that is, leave for Camp David by 8 o'clock. My presence can sometime make the difference in getting him off. And seeing the Hirshhorn collection in an hour is something of an insult. It should be savored slowly, luxuriously, like a delicious candlelit banquet, instead of gulped like a hamburger. But my philosophy is that there's only today, and what I don't do now, I may never do. So we went. The countryside was beautiful, in spite of all this talk I hear about a drought in New York. Green and plush and rolling. Geographically, I don't know much about where I was, but it was so like the country on the way to Mary Lasker's. Linda was with me, and I was a little concerned to hear that my 21-year-old was going to bid me goodbye at the airport, go back into New York, and spend the weekend having dates, playing bridge with Dave and his friends. She'd been to Arthur the night before, and came home with stories of the incredible people, Carol Channing in her white bell-bottom trousers trimmed in red, and a midi blouse top, and a huge alarm clock hanging around her neck, and her 2-inch artificial eyelashes, was completely inconspicuous. She said there were only about 2 people on the floor who looked like they were having a good time as they danced. The rest were in a sort of trance. Some looked in agony as they gyrated about. Sybil had been at home, they heard, with fever 103. They did see her husband, and a handsome young man he was. About 3, we reached the Joseph Hirshhorn residence. A winding driveway led through rhododendron and tall elms up a gentle hill, topped by a dignified, impressive residence, rather English. And there, all similarity to anything I had ever seen before ended. Right in the middle of the circular driveway, in a plot of green, were 5 or 6 huge figures, the burghers of Calais, in chains, marvelous expressions, agony, dignity, endurance, self-sacrifice, by Rodin. Our host, all of 5'2", bouncy, delightful, one of the most interesting men I've met, was at the driveway to meet us, and his pretty, warm, attractive, much younger wife, together with his curator and wife and his lawyer, Sam Harris, and wife. From then on, For the next hour, it was, for me, exciting high living, being pelted by impression after impression, a traditional old-fashioned piece of sculpture, and then some waving wands of aluminum that are rather bolted together to have a certain balance but sway in the wind, some follower of Calder, I suppose, and Henry Moore, many, many Henry Moore, I think he says he has more than anyone in this country, his favorite being the King and Queen, seated on a bench in the center of his rose garden, not at all clearly defined figures of a man and a woman, but with the fewest lines and molding, depicting nevertheless a certain dignity and quiet and importance. And then there was the one that I call the Hungry Dog Sculptor, because one of his pieces is a very lean, emaciated dog that looks like he's made out of some igneous rock, some fried and bubbled and pitted material that was left in the bottom of the pot when the burning was over. There were all sorts of medium, marble and bronze and wood, some of it painted, and steel and aluminum, and others I didn't even recognize. After a while, you began to see similarities, to be able to recognize them. There was the African influence, and there were some pre-Columbian things. But nothing that I saw was more interesting than our host himself, who told me how he'd been collecting for 40 years, delighting in finding something that had not struck the eye yet of the world, and buying it at a moderate price, to see it rise and become the very expensive thing of the 2 decades later. About every 15 minutes, Bess would say, if we're going to catch that plane, we have to leave in 45 minutes or 30 minutes or whatever. And our hostess would offer us a drink. We would snatch it up and keep on walking, I asking questions. None of us willing, least of all me, to stop and think about planes or drinks. The setting, too, was exquisite. Beautifully kept lawns sloping off into misty vistas visible between tall trees. A rose garden, some formal box. What a wrench it must be for him to even think of letting it go. And yet, in a way, that is why I am here, because I hope that he will give it to Washington, where thousands of people can see his possessions. But being the world's poorest salesman, I never mentioned what are your plans for it, although he said a couple of times, well, yes, we'd love to have you come back, but you know, you must come back before long. It won't be here. After a while, there is talk that the Tate in London is wooing him with promises to build practically a second Taj Mahal, and that all sorts of New York museums are wanting the collection. It is said to be the most outstanding one in private hands. We went inside, and I saw a couple of his Aikens. He has some enormous figure in the 30s, or maybe in the 50s. These were very commanding character portraits, with something of the quality of the Flemish masters. And then there was a most adorable child, handsome, all misty and delicate, an attractive couple sitting on a balcony, having dinner, looking down into a Paris street. And to my delight, some little clay figures, some Tlaki Paki near Guadalajara. Perhaps he might even be from my friend Juan Aldano's own shop. Familiar dove and owl and roadrunner. Just as we were about to leave, Mr. Hirshhorn gave us one for Linda, one for Lucy. Two pre-Columbian figures. I think I can see the plumed serpent in the headdress of one. And then we were off in a whirl of goodbyes. Looked at a box of Linda's pictures, wonderful they were, of her western trip, Grand Canyon, Yosemite, San Simeon, Jackson Hole. An anxious mother talk at the airport. When will you be home? Take care. And then I arrived at the White House at 7. To find that we had house guests, Arthur and Matilda Krim, and Bill Deason. And Lyndon was calling me, saying he'd like to get off to Camp David. He'd already done the inviting. Besides those, Marianne Means and Emmett Reardon, and Sissy Morrissey, and others to come tomorrow. It was after 9 before we left, and I told Mathilda, when we entered the woods, everyone put down their burden of cares and walked in free. They're balm to Lyndon, quiet, intelligent, and the fact that she's so pretty is a pleasure for him. Bill Deason has bought a house, and he and Jeannie and the children are moving to Washington to be on some commission. The Bill Whites were along, too. We had dinner and drinks as soon as we arrived, and still it was 12 when we got to bed.